This is Central Time. Now, while child marriage and female genital mutilation have been made illegal in Kenya, it could take time to change strong cultural traditions. The work of the Samburu Girls Foundation is to rescue girls facing these circumstances and then maybe even sponsor them to attend school. The founder herself escaped child marriage. One UW-Madison professor has been working with the Samburu Girls Foundation for years in partnership with other people and groups. Her latest goal is to provide an easier way for the girls at the foundation to access clean drinking water. Leslie Sager started working in Kenya in 2012 and is the founder of Mary Go Strong, a nonprofit that nurtures sustainable grassroots development through collaborative community initiatives that foster social and economic well-being. She's also a faculty associate and the director of the Design Thinking Initiative at the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. Leslie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Well, tell us first about the kind of the basic mission and a bit of the history of the Samburu Girls Foundation.
Well, the Samburu Girls Foundation was originally, it was originated in 2012, and it was developed by a woman named Josephine Kulea, who had been rescued herself from child marriage. She'd gone to another school outside of Samburu, and during that time, she realized that the practices of child marriage and FGM were not typical. So when she returned home, she then started to do her own rescues. And she also went to university and was able to get a nursing degree. And with that income, she started to rescue girls herself and has been supporting girls ever since. It got to the point where she was using all her money. So she started the foundation, and that's where it began.
And you and others here in the United States are working to help her and help the foundation. Before we get into particulars of how you do that, it seems like one key for you and the people you're working with is we're not coming in from the outside and saying, here's how you fix this. You're really saying, what do you need? You are there on the ground. How can we help?
Yes, it's all about getting to know what their resources are and helping work with them. We have a number of different initiatives going on. A lot of them include University of Wisconsin students from SOHI, the School of Human Ecology. So we work on different projects that we then test out there, such as helping them with their beadwork or doing color combinations, for example, or training them how to make their own solar-powered lamps. Or I have a group coming up that's going to be working with them on teaching them how to sew their own water-carrying vests so that they can carry their own water. So we do little things. The idea is that little things can make an enormous difference, and those are some of the projects.
And this, you work with people who are doing design, and a lot of the design you're doing with the foundation there sounds like it's aimed at things like economic self-sufficiency, or in the case of those water carriers, being able to do their daily tasks a little more easily.
Exactly. So one of the issues is, after talking to Josephine, is that she really needs a school there so that she can keep everything controlled, so that because she sends all the girls away to boarding schools, and it would be much easier for her to have them there. But one of the issues is that because a lot of them start school so late, they are not always able to make it to a university, and therefore they end up back into the community and not necessarily fulfilling some of their own dreams. So one of the things that we're working on is figuring out different ways that they can make an income and creating workshops around that, such as making beautiful jewelry, learning how to sew, learning how to make soap, writing, different things that they're interested in.
So you've got a partnership with the Samburu Girls Foundation, but you also have other partners here in Wisconsin and in the U.S. Can you talk about kind of the team that's come together here?
Yes. Oh, I'm so excited about this team. It's just been a miracle, and they're amazing. So I work with Mike Ford. He's known as the Hip Hop Architect, and he has hip hop architecture camps that he runs all throughout the United States for youth to teach them about architecture and to combine music with architecture. And he's really, really great at empowering them and empowering their creativity. So I've been able to work with him. We kind of met serendipitously because he needed to use a laser cutter and I was available to help him and for one of his camps. And then I was able to meet with Jasmine Zapata, Dr. Jasmine Zapata, who's a pediatrician in town. She's written a number of books on girls' empowerment and the beauty within. One of her books is Beyond Beautiful. And I'd met her at, we were actually neighbors at the Brava Expo, and I was able to talk to her about her book. I bought her book, and some students of mine produced a small journal, which we then took to Kenya, and the girls there got to read the journal. So we're working at all kinds of angles. We're working at helping build the center, the rescue center, and having the girls at the rescue center contribute. So Mike Ford will actually be going to Kenya, working with the girls, running one of the first hip-hop architecture camps in Kenya. And Jasmine is currently recording her lessons through her book, which we will be showing and working with the girls there as well.
So there's people, your students have gone or will be going to Kenya, trips over there. But also I understand the founder of the Samburu Girls Foundation is speaking at an event here in Wisconsin coming up.
Yes, she is. She will be here at the University Club on May 5th. The name of the event is Step One Water, and because the first thing we need is to bring water to the campus before we can actually make anything else happen. So we're looking to learn more, have people learn more about the activities that we're doing around water. We actually have a company called Zero Mass Water that is able to get water from the atmosphere with their panels. It's amazing. And they are going to be installing 40 panels at the foundation because we can't drill for water. We can't get, it's very arid there, so there's no access to water underground. So we have to get it from the atmosphere.
Thank you so much, Leslie, for sharing the story today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Leslie Sager is the founder of the nonprofit Mary Go Strong. She's a faculty associate and the director of the Design Thinking Initiative at the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. We've been talking about her work and her partnerships working with the Samburu Girls Foundation. The founder of that group from Kenya is speaking at an event in Madison, as we just heard, on Saturday, May 5th at the University Club. More info at Mary Go Strong. That's M-E-R-R-Y, by the way. MaryGoStrong.com. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Over the last 5 years, police chases on Wisconsin roads have become much more common, increasing about 200% statewide. Some chases have reached speeds of 90 or 100 miles per hour, putting officers and bystanders at risk. A new investigation finds that differing police tactics between communities and an evolving drug trade could be part of the story here. Keegan Kyle is an investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. Keegan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, reading your reporting on this, Keegan, there's this overall increase in the state, and it seems like a lot of the story is in Milwaukee County, in Milwaukee and surrounding communities. What's going on there?
Well, in southeastern Wisconsin, there's definitely been an increase in police chases. A lot of police departments across the area credit Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Police Department, with some of that increase. But even in suburban communities, there are other problems going on attributed to changes in suspect behaviors or changes in the drug trade that continue to evolve and challenge officers across the state.
One thing going on here is that police departments have policies on, okay, when do we pursue in a high-speed chase, when don't we? And that is not the same. It's different from one community to the next, right?
Exactly. Yeah, some places feel that the risk is too great to challenge or to chase drivers in urban places, particularly or during dangerous driving conditions. So the police officers will actually stop pursuing. Other places have a different barometer for what is the risk evaluation versus letting that person go. There continues to be a sense in some police departments that if you were to let a driver go, that increases the amount of dangerous traffic that is continuing on roads, or you might be missing a dangerous offender.
Talk about the city of Milwaukee, because that's been in the news over the last few years, a change in policy and then kind of a change, not quite all the way back, but another switch. Talk about the history of that.
Sure. Back in 2010, after a series of fatal police chases, so there were a few incidences where innocent bystanders were actually killed, but as a result of police chases moving through. Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn at the time imposed stricter requirements for police chases to happen. His main concern, again, was that officers and bystanders were getting hurt and he wanted to try to restrict how often and the conditions that police officers were chasing after suspects. After that restriction went in place, the Milwaukee Police Department's chases went dropped quite a bit, but there started to be problems emerging in both Milwaukee and other communities that some authorities now attribute to the Milwaukee Police Department's policy. Most recently, the Milwaukee Police Department last year expanded the conditions that officers could chase after suspects. They were worried that the restrictions that Police Chief Ed Flynn imposed were having unintended consequences.
Right, that might include people moving drug trafficking right from standing to being in a car and then thinking, okay, well, we know we can get away. They're not going to chase us. And that was one of the concerns that led them to loosen up the policy on chases.
Right. So there have been a couple cases in Milwaukee, and we've heard concerns quite a bit from police departments about drug traffickers delivering drugs through cars rather than on street corners or drug houses, more traditional methods. And as part of that, part of the thinking behind that method is that having a more mobile delivery system and the police department policies on chases might allow drug traffickers to evade authorities a little bit more easily than they have in the past at, you know, street corners and drug houses. It's also contributing, according to police, it ties in with the auto theft, a surge in auto theft across southeastern Wisconsin, because often stolen cars are being used to deliver these drugs.
And there's a concern, you write, in communities right next door to Milwaukee that because Milwaukee had cut back on its chases, you had people either coming out of Milwaukee into their communities or people being confused about where they were and driving away thinking they wouldn't be chased. And that led to an increase in police chases in some of those communities.
Exactly. So police departments in the surrounding communities raised concerns that, these drug dealers did not know where they were. So they might be in another city, but they believe that they weren't going to be chased, so they might drive a little bit more recklessly. They also voiced concerns that maybe they did know where they were, but they decided to speed off and try to run back to Milwaukee where they perceived to be looser restrictions. So that the combination of those perceptions just created kind of a dangerous mix that a lot of suburban communities raised concerns about.
And still a work in progress here, it sounds like. Keegan, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you.
That's Keegan Kyle, investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin, with us to talk about a rise in police chases in the state, especially southeastern Wisconsin, over the last five-year period. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Syracuse University in upstate New York permanently expelled its campus Theta Tau fraternity after videos became public of the students yelling racial slurs and mocking people who are disabled. A video released days ago showed the mock sexual assault of a fraternity member pretending to be a person with an intellectual disability. The fraternity chapter said the skits that were recorded were satirical in nature, but the videos caused outrage across the country and students protested on Syracuse University's campus. Our next guest is here to talk about the controversy and what the future of fraternity life could look like on campuses across the country. Nolan Cabrera is an associate professor in the Center for the Study of Higher Education at the University of Arizona. Nolan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
You've been watching, Nolan, issues like this over the years. What was your reaction when these videos came out?
I'm actually more surprised that people are surprised. I know that sounds kind of a little counterintuitive, but it's very predictable. Every year another thing comes up like this, and central administration treats it as a few bad apples issue. We saw that with the University of Oklahoma and the "there will never be an N-word in SAE" chant. And so it's a predictable response. Either suspend, expel, give some sanctions to the students, and then just continue on as business as usual. And if you continue with business as usual, you're going to keep getting these results.
So these aren't, you feel like, isolated incidents. These are the isolated incidents that we hear about that come out and maybe just the tip of the iceberg?
Absolutely. I mean, I've spent the last decade talking to white male undergraduates as part of my research agenda, and they consistently tell me about some horrifically racist things that happen in their everyday life, and yet they just don't see it as a problem. Like, for example, 90% of the ones that I interviewed in the last round of research regularly either hear or use the N-word on a regular basis, and two-thirds don't think that there's anything wrong with it.
Is there something about fraternities that makes uniquely bad things happen, or are they just places out of the public eye where what everybody is thinking actually gets said out loud?
I think it's kind of a both and. I mean, they are extreme sites of social isolation in institutions of higher education. It makes sense that in a really perverse way that the young men at Syracuse University were making fun of handicapped people and Latinos and Jews, because you look around, those people were not physically present there. And so they continue to ask the question, you know, they continue to frame it, well, this was a satire. But I keep coming back to the issue as, if this is a satire, it's supposed to be funny, or at least, you know, and so if it's funnier for whom and at whose expense? And it seems to be funnier for white male, straight undergraduates, able-bodied undergraduates, at the expense of people who are not like them.
Now, in this particular case at Syracuse University, the administration there expelled the fraternity itself, basically shut it down. What do you think of their reaction?
It's a good but predictable start. So the real test of their willpower moving forward is, what are you actually going to do to address this issue on a more systemic level? When fully 30% of the students on your campus are associated with Greek life, and keep in mind that Greek life is one of the only areas in an institution of higher education where you can explicitly exclude people from participation. It's not coincidental that you have these really racially homogenous learning living environments, and that this is predictable. So then the question to central administration is, okay, good first step, what are you going to do next?
It is a unique institution at our institutions of higher learning, the fraternities and sororities. Do you see, is there a positive side that they have, could have on campuses?
I mean, there's always benefits that you can have from any organization. The difficulty that I've had is that, you know, over the last 30 years, this is the site of the highest amount of code of conduct violations, and these issues keep coming up. And are they exclusively part of this this system, the Greek system? No, of course not. People make fun of disabled folk all the time. People make fun of Latinos all the time. But again, it stems from that social isolation. That if you don't have anyone with, you know, I think they were trying to mock somebody with cerebral palsy, or if you don't have anybody like that in your immediate vicinity, it's really easy to mock and make fun, because you're not making fun of a person, you're making fun of a concept, of an idea. And it's a lot more difficult and a lot more telling when you know, if you really think something is funny, then you would do, and you actually, then you would do it to the in the presence of the person who you're actually critiquing, who you're actually satirizing.
How far back do these traditions, these things we might not want to see happening on campuses, how far back do they go at fraternities?
They're endemic. They're part of the social foundation of Greek life. Greek life was meant to, in many respects, establish kind of within higher education, already an elite institution, establish sort of an aristocracy within that. And then there's even, levels of prestige, differential levels of prestige associated with being in different ones. And the overall idea is that you know, if you're necessarily trying to, you know, close off your social circle and really provide a space for the recreation of social privilege, that necessarily means that the core of what you were doing is the elimination of people who are, the exclusion of people who are not like you. And so that means, you know, there's been systematic disqualification of Jews from Greek life, of low-income folks, of any racial minority, of handicapped folk, of any kind of a social identity that you can identify that doesn't fit sort of this model social norm. It's been there from the beginning.
With this Syracuse case in particular, again, the national group, the national organization of this fraternity condemned this chapter's behavior at Syracuse. Do you think that the overall national organizations of fraternities are sending a strong enough message for about the behavior of their local chapters?
Absolutely not, especially because there's always an implicit message sent to central administration that we as represent as fraternity and Greek letter organization alumni, that we represent one of the strongest alumni bases in terms of fundraising. So go ahead and crack down on these guys as an isolated incident, but don't you dare. I mean, the message that central administration folk frequently receive is don't you dare mess with our traditions. We'll treat this as the few bad apples, but don't you dare mess with our fraternity or you may suffer the consequences of a lack of funding going into next year.
As you mentioned earlier, part of your research has been talking to young men in college who are part of these fraternities. How much of this do they bring in with them from their own background? How much of this is passed on to them, this racist and other behavior is passed on from the fraternity, those traditions that they're joining into?
Oh, it's definitely a combination of both. You know, I don't want to say that, you know, it's only in fraternities that these young men learn to be racist or sexist or homophobic, but it is a situation where it gets enhanced, where the messaging they receive frequently is that this kind of behavior is absolutely acceptable, that it's okay. And again, a lot of it stems from that social isolation. Like when I talk to white men, in addition to using the N-word, they tell racist jokes on a very regular basis. But then I ask them, well, you know, who do you tell it in front of? And almost exclusively it's in front of their white male peers. I say, well, why don't you tell it in front of, you know, if you're making a joke about black guys, why don't you tell it in front of black people? And they're like, well, no, they would take it out of context. They're overly sensitive. And never is it a situation where, oh, wow, I might be being a little racist here. And so it's one of those things that it becomes this echo chamber of we're not racist. We don't hate people of color. We don't hate disabled people. We don't hate Jewish people. And so any of our actions are a joke, a satire. In many respects, that's how it gets brushed off. Like, oh, come on, man. Why are you so sensitive? It's just a joke.
Now, these students, as you mentioned, they're in an elite institution, going to a university. They're in theoretically an elite group within that as a member of a fraternity. This was an engineering fraternity at Syracuse, for example. People in fraternities, when they're pitching their organization to new members, they go on to do big things in government, business, uh-huh. Things like that. What do you worry about if this is going on there and then these people are, in fact, going on to do bigger and better things?
I mean, it's a natural extension of the workplace that, you know, you still, if you become the big boss, you have a lot of leverage in terms of who you want to hire and bring into your inner circle. You know, I mean, these are explicitly seen as mechanisms of social networking. And if that's who's in your social network, then you're going to end up, it's not coincidental that you keep seeing at Fortune 500 companies this kind of, you know, a lack of diversity, racially hostile climates, you know, Silicon Valley, the tech bros, again, it's not saying that there's a one-to-one correlation of, you know, I did this in college, so it's going to happen in my job, but it's definitely not coincidental that when people are, you know, trying to strive for more elite social status and they're getting people who are explicitly like them, that a lot of these problems will continue to persist in the workplace as well.
Are many people having a fundamental conversation about maybe some of what you see as basic fundamental problems, or is this going to be a case where we're surprised at this video, we were surprised at the Oklahoma video, we're going to be surprised at who knows where's video next year?
I fully expect that if you think that this segment goes well right now, that in, you know, 16 months time you'll be calling me again. And there'll be another outrage and another incident that goes viral because someone was videotaping. The larger structural issues are a lot more difficult to address, to deal with, and you get actually a lot of pushback from that. If institutions of higher education really want to try to tackle the race problem, there's a lot of flack that they get from that, and so it's very predictable that, you know, sort of tie this one off, don't deal with the underlying structural issues, and, you know, hey, we'll have a conversation in a few months when the next incident comes up.
We'll leave it there for now. Nolan, thanks for joining us today.
Great. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
That's Nolan Cabrera, associate professor in the Center for the Study of Higher Education at the University of Arizona. He joins us today to talk about the recent videos from a Syracuse University fraternity, which showed members mocking people with disabilities, students yelling about hating various minority groups, and what he says are fundamental problems with fraternity life on American campuses.